Up next, the historic flight of Apollo 11, the first manned landing on the moon, and a very special interview with a friend of the program, the late retired NBC TV news reporter, Roy Neal.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
If the truth were known, we really delayed this launch so we could get the burritos on time.
I figured that.
The flight director says get back in.
We lost the flight plan out the window.
On all three networks, you replaced all the kitty cartoons.
Houston, we've had a problem.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
I was strolling on the moon one day.
Counter, go and throttle up.
The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
You're listening to The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.
The flight of Apollo 11. This is Rich Kirshner reporting. The historic flight of Apollo 11's first manned landing on the moon took place in July of 1969. Astronauts Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins were to conduct this historic mission. We were kindly joined by the late NBC TV news reporter Roy Neal for his reactions and insights on the mission. All right, first question, and we're going to go back a little ways. How did you find yourself covering space news back in the old days, back in the golden age of space travel?
It's a very long story. It really began when I was back in Philadelphia, starting in television. And I made a good connection with the Saturday Evening Post, a then-famous magazine. Through their auspices, I was able to cover such things as the first flights of the B-47 and the B-52. They cleared the way for me. Well, then when I went to California to set up the NBC newsroom out there, it seemed logical that I should go to Edwards Air Force Base, which was a mecca for all sorts of research aircraft. And that, in turn, led to coverage of high-speed aircraft. And at the same time, we were covering nuclear weaponry, which was being tested in the Nevada desert. All this went into the mix so that when NASA came along back in about 1958, just seemed like a good idea to start covering rocketry in its early stages. Mm. And one thing led to another, to another, to another, to a point where NBC let me specialize in that field. I covered the Manson trial, for example, and
wow.
You name it, as a correspondent, you cover everything, but they did allow me to specialize, in this case, in aerospace.
So when anything came up in aerospace or space, you were asked to cover it immediately, or just...
I was given the loose assignment of staying on top of things and telling them what to cover.
How did you prepare for space mission coverage, and what was your homework like?
When I would go out on a space flight, I usually carried about 25 pounds worth of books. That was research material. It was remarkable, but NASA realized that most people had to have information if their programs were to be covered correctly. And when first I came aboard through the Air Force route since they were building rockets. So what happened was they briefed me at the beginning, then after a while, as things became a little more sophisticated, they started putting out huge books filled with information, and the Air Force's example led to what NASA did when NASA came along to do the same. You may remember, incidentally, that in the beginning, almost all of the rockets that flew were military in nature. It wasn't until a little later that NASA developed its own. The Saturn, for example, was pure Wernher von Braun. Now, von Braun's background was military, as you know, German military of all things. But on the other side of the coin, he did know what he was doing in rocketry, and he designed and built the Saturn rocket that took us to the moon.
How was your access to NASA personnel and astronauts? How was your access?
Because I had begun in the beginning, when NASA first was formed. As a matter of fact, when NACA, the National Aeronautics Advisory Council on Aeronautics, became NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, I was there for the for the ceremony. I was there at the beginning and was able, as a result, to look in on everything that they were doing as they began to evolve their plans and their projects. This gave me a decided in, to say nothing of the fact that both the military and NASA had a screaming desire to tell the public what they were doing from a standpoint of accuracy. This because nobody knew much about rocketry at the time, and it was very easy to make tremendous mistakes, which could have resulted in a rather disastrous situation for the public at large if incorrectly reported. So I was given good access all the way through. It might surprise you to know, for example, that with every astronaut that ever flew in those early days, we did an obituary piece. Every one of them, on camera, talked about the fact that if I die in the process of experimental flight, it's in the cause of the nation and the research programs. And so with that kind of access, I think you can see that we were in pretty tightly. We did use material on the Apollo 1 fire with Grissom, White, and Chaffee. We used all of that material at that time. But that was the first time that we really used our obit pieces.
When Apollo 1 shook the nation, how did you respond to that event? And since there was no live coverage when it happened, how did you deal with that? Where were you, and how were you involved with that? What happened?
At the time of Apollo 1, I was at my home in California. They were getting ready for a flight, and I hadn't yet come down to the Cape. And if you remember, they were doing a rather routine check. Grissom was quite some concerned. He felt he had a lemon of a spacecraft. He didn't quite realize that the entire program was off on a wrong track, and one that sooner or later would have resulted in disaster, which it did. I heard about it by telephone because my office called me and said, here's what happened. You'd better get into the office quickly. So I went into the studios in Burbank, went on the air that night using some of my obituary material and talking about the people that had just died and the wonderful people that they were. And I drew the conclusion even early on that this was a mistake that had to happen, that NASA had incorrectly designed its spacecraft, meaning, of course, that they were dealing with 15 pounds per square inch of pure oxygen, which will create an explosion with the slightest spark. We have 5 PSI oxygen in our current atmosphere. But there they were dealing with a tremendous concentration, and it was just a bomb waiting to go off. So we had to have the Apollo 1 fire to progress on into space, and that was something that came out during that early coverage, that very first night.
Now, I talked to Walter Cunningham. He was on Apollo 7, and they were the backup crew, and they were the first flight to go off after that. And they had mentioned how shocked they were, and all of the improvements that took place as a result of that fire. You know, that, yes, there was some good that came out of it. They didn't die for nothing.
Don't be misled by one thing, Rich. There's nothing wrong with a pure oxygen atmosphere. The concentration of oxygen is the danger factor. Remember what I was just talking about. 15 is an explosive mixture. 5 pounds per square inch is what you live with every day of the week. As a result, pure oxygen is a very versatile and very usable environment, and it saves a lot of weight.
I actually was not aware about the concentration being that much of a factor in a fire hazard.
What trapped them was that they had to build this thin-walled spacecraft so that our atmosphere at 15 pounds per square inch of pressure wouldn't collapse the spacecraft. That's how they got to the 15 pounds per square inch. In space, all they needed was the 5 pounds, and they could bleed off the excess oxygen. But on the surface, they had to have full 15 pounds. And that was the trap into which they fell.
Well, it seems like you've done your homework. These are things that I've done a lot of research and reading, and I don't profess to be an expert by any means, but you've got some facts there that I'd never even heard of, and it's impressive, and it would be nice to have somebody like you still covering space missions to this day.
Unfortunately, age catches up to all of us. Right now, I finally turned 80 not too long ago, and at this stage of the game, the old body is beginning to break down ever so slowly and ever so surely.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We now continue with reactions to the mission from friend of the program, the late retired news reporter from NBC TV, Roy Neal. Apollo 11, it was one of the monuments of world history, and you were in the center of it and looking around. And looking back, what are some of your thoughts of the mission, some of the things that really touched you that you still have long-lasting impressions of?
I think the first impression was one of awe, the fact that we were actually able to mount an expedition to the moon in such a short period of time, and that we had gone through this entire track, which included the Apollo 1 fire, to get there and to be in position to fly. The second thought that I had at that time was a great fear on behalf of the crew that were going to fly it. Neil Armstrong was one of my very good friends. I had known him when he was flying X-15s out in California. And I didn't want anything to happen to any one of them. And so I had quite some concern on behalf of the crew, because the equipment was really not that well known by the engineers who were flying it. On the other hand, there was at least a 50-50 chance that they'd make it. And as you know, there was a great race going on between us and the Russians, which, as it turned out, was not as much of a race as we thought it was. However, in the throes of all that, as they mounted that mission, I think all of us had the same feeling. Here we go, folks. Pray a lot. And so we did. And the mission, of course, was highly successful. It accomplished everything that it set out to do. And we got away with it. Got away with it on Apollo 12. It wasn't until Apollo 13 that things broke down.
Now, where were you actually at when Neil Armstrong stepped on the moon? Were you in the Mission Control Center?
No, I was at the Mission Control Center on the outside looking in. At that time, the media were not allowed in the control center proper. The only time that anybody ever was in the Mission Control proper was for Apollo 13, when NASA relented and allowed a pool correspondent, which was me, to go in and physically sit in the control center. But I was on the outskirts of it in a NASA newsroom setting. And in this case, one of our own making right across the street from the Johnson Space Center, watching avidly as the developments took place. Bud Dancy was there with me as another NBC correspondent, and the two of us were watching and reporting as we went along.
Do you speak about it much with your friends and colleagues, or do you kind of shy away and talk about, flowers and weather?
No. This was a major influence on my life, and among my very good friends are most of the guys who did most of the flying at that time, so we all get together quite frequently, and we talk about it and remember it with fondness, I might add. But, it was the greatest thing about it, I think, was we were living an adventure story. An adventure story that, for the most part, had a happy ending. Now, you can't ask for a better combination than that, particularly for a reporter.
At the time, could you comprehend that the whole world was watching their televisions when Armstrong stepped on the moon, or were you just riveted at the time? Were you glued to the TV set or monitor? How were your feelings at that time?
I think you have to remember that if you are a reporter, and I like to think of myself as one, you're there to report the story, not to have personal emotions. Obviously, you will have some personal emotion. You can't eliminate that. But basically, you don't think of that huge audience that's out there. You think instead, what's happening now? How do I explain this so that somebody who doesn't know what's going on can understand what's going on? And so you're talking your way through the story as it develops before your eyes, and through the medium of television, which is the greatest medium of all time, you can do this sort of thing because it unfolds the story for you to see and to share. So there we were, sharing the experience, and my concentration was primarily on just explaining what was going on. It wasn't until after the fact that I realized what a tremendous undertaking we had had, and that was made rather easy for me too, Rich, because I was doing a big album for Capitol Records. NBC had given me special permission to do this. So we were recording everything that was important from the air to ground all the way through the mission. And when the mission was finished, I went into Mission Control after it had emptied out, and I then recorded the entire mission, the whole album, in Mission Control for about 3 to 4 hours, following the facts. And remembering all the things that we had just shared and just lived through. This was a great memory bank on which to draw. And I imagine as a result of it, I was probably closer to that flight than anybody except for the people who were actually flying it.
I remember some words from Gene Kranz that he was so overwhelmed, even though he was a flight director, so involved in the day-to-day operations, every minute at the console, telling people what to do, getting input from the other controllers. And he would speak about his emotions and how he would be overwhelmed at times. And I just couldn't, I could actually imagine how that could happen, just based on the fact that, you have to sit back and for just a moment think, this is happening. You know, we're actually going to the moon. It's, I can't, you know, when you look up the moon right now, it's a small disk in the sky, and I try to imagine what it would look like if it would fill the sky.
Well, watch Gene Grant's in action. I can tell you right now that if his concentration was at all diverted, it certainly never showed when he was on the floor wearing his funny vests and being in total control of everything that happened.
Did he have a different vest for every mission, kind of like Apollo 13's movie indicated?
Carefully made by his wife.
All right, now for the most traditional program question. What's your favorite food, and what do you want for Christmas?
My favorite food is a nice, juicy steak, usually accompanied by a baked potato, which is mundane, perhaps, but that's the way it is. As far as what I'd like for Christmas, I'm an Abbott ham radio operator, and I've got a very fine station. But there's always something new that you would like to put into the station. At the moment, I don't have any single piece of gear in mind, but I'm sure I could find one that would fill the bill.
Is there any QSL card you're looking for right now?
No. I've never been much of a QSL card chaser, although I've got some rather good ones from people that I've gotten to know on the way through, like Hussein of Jordan. He flew one of my crews over to his palace so that we could cover him for one of the videotapes that I did for the American Radio Relay League. That was quite an experience.
Reactions, insights, and some really good stuff from the late NBC News reporter, Roy Neal. This is Rich Kirshner reporting.
You're listening to The Space Program.
At 9:32 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, on July 16, 1969, Apollo 11 left Launch Complex 39A at the Kennedy Space Center, bound for the moon. Aboard were Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, and Buzz Aldrin.
T-minus 60 seconds and counting. We pass T-minus 60. 55 seconds and counting. Neil Armstrong just reported back. It's been a real smooth countdown. We passed the 50-second mark. Power transfer is complete. We're on internal power with the launch vehicle at this time. 40 seconds away from the Apollo 11 liftoff. All the second stage tanks now pressurized. 35 seconds and counting. We are still go with Apollo 11. 30 seconds and counting. Astronauts report it feels good. T-minus 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower cleared.
Here we got a roll program.
Neil Armstrong reporting the roll and pitch program, which puts Apollo 11 on a proper heading. Altitude's 2 miles.
Oh, well, in Houston, you're good at 1 minute.
Downrange 1 mile, altitude 3-4 miles now. Velocity 2,195 feet per second. Region of maximum dynamic pressure now. Set 8 miles downrange, 12 miles high. Velocity 4,000 feet per second.
Stand by for mode 1, Charlie. Mark, mode 1, Charlie.
1, Charlie.
Cliff Charlesworth taking a staging status.
This is Houston. You are go for staging. Inboard cutoff.
Inboard engines out.
I'm inboard cutoff.
Downrange 35 miles, 30 miles high. Standing by for the outboard engine cut down now.
There it is, right on the pitch.
And ignition. 11 Houston, thrust is go. All engines, you're looking good. Hi, Roger, you're loud and clear, Houston.
At 3 minutes, downrange 70 miles, 43 miles high, velocity 9,300 feet per second.
We got skirts up. Roger, we confirm skirts up. Tower's gone. Roger, tower.
Neil Armstrong confirming both the engine skirt separation and the launch escape tower separation.
Houston, be advised, the visual is go today. This is Houston, Roger out. Yeah, they finally gave me a window to look out.
The crew achieved Earth orbit, checked out their systems, and performed the translunar injection burn to put Apollo 11 on its way to the moon. En route to the moon, the astronauts beamed a live television transmission back to the Earth.
11 Houston, the definition is pretty good on our monitor here. The color's not too varsity, at least on this set. Could you describe what you're looking at? Over.
Roger, you're seeing Earth as we see it at our left-hand window. It's a little more than a half Earth. We're looking at the eastern Pacific Ocean, and the north half of the top half of the screen, we can see North America, Alaska, United States, Canada, Mexico, and Central America. South America becomes invisible just off beyond the Terminator or inside the shadow. You can see the oceans with a definite blue cast. See white bands of major cloud formations across the Earth. And can see coastlines that got the western U.S., San Joaquin Valley, the Sierra Mountain Range, the peninsula of Baja California, and can see some cloud formations over southeastern U.S. There's one definite mild storm southwest of Alaska. Looks like about 500 to 1,000 miles. And another very minor storm showing the south end of the screen near the, a long way south of the equator, probably 45 degrees or more south latitude. Pick out the ground, the browns in the landforms pretty well. The greens do not show up very well. Some green showing along the northeastern, northwestern coast of the United States and northwestern coast of Canada.
Hey, world, hold on to your hat. I'm going to turn you upside down.
11, that's a pretty good roll there.
That's pretty sloppy, darn. Let me try that one again.
You'll never beat out the Thunderbirds.
I'm making myself seasick doing it, Charlie. I'll just put you back right side up where you belong.
Roger. 11, Houston, if you could comply, we'd like to see some smiling faces up there. If you could give us some interior views, I'm sure everybody'd like to see you. Over.
Okay, we'll reconfigure the TV for that.
Roger. That's Big Mike Collins there.
Well, you got a little bit of... Yeah, hello there, sports fans. You got a little bit of me, plus Neil's in the center couch, and Buzz is doing the camera work this time.
Roger.
Well, I put on a coat and tie if I'd known about this ahead of time.
Is Buzz holding your cue cards for you, over?
Cue cards have a no. We have no intention of competing with the professionals, believe me. We are very comfortable up here, though. We do have a happy home. There's plenty of room for the three of us, and I think we're all learning to find our favorite little corner to sit in. The zero-G is very comfortable, but after a while, you get to the point where you sort of get tired of rattling around and banging off the ceiling and the floor and the side, so you you tend to find a little corner somewhere and put your knees up or something like that to wedge yourself in, and that seems more at home.
History was about to happen. You'll hear it on the next episode of The Space Program, The Flight of Apollo 11. This is Rich Kirshner reporting.
From the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, and God bless all of you on the good Earth.
This has been The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.